Accession number 10768, reel 10.
Mr. John Granger, Reel 10. You were telling me about the attack, and you just got through Havrincourt Wood.
Yes, we got through. When you got through the wood, well, then there it was. All open land, sloping upwards for about half a mile. And apparently, at the top there, when you got right to the top of that hill, that was the one side of what they called the Dry Canal, and the object was to get up to the top there, clearing Jerry gradually, and then you had to go down and back up again. And when he was going down, when he got to the apex, you were a standing target, weren't you? Anyway, it was about, as I say, it was about 8 o'clock in the morning when we got through the wood, and just outside the wood, about say halfway up the hill there was trenches, and then we went in there in those trenches, and that's when we got our room ration and everything, and we were waiting for going, and they sat aside at 8 o'clock. No, 9 o'clock.
What would the scene like be in the trench before you jumped out, before you went into the tank? What would people be doing standing waiting?
Well, you're just standing waiting. You couldn't be playing bloody football. Not then, no. There's nothing except, you're just waiting and hoping to God it'd soon be over.
Did people look nervous?
There's no need to. But what the hell was the need to get nervous? You knew you'd got to do it, and you couldn't do anything about it. So all you got to do was blank your mind out about it and see how it goes on.
And you think that's what most people were doing?
Yes, you had to control yourself, absolutely. There was no use getting a flap on or anything like that, because you would only upset some of the other lads. But when it came, when it started, that was what started it, was to say, when the 45s put a big barrage on. Well, we'd got a Scottish regiment on our right, and on the left we got what they call a naval division, you see, and this was all the way along. The British Army was that was a big advance that clears us right back to Cambria. And that was when Derry had more or less finished, you see. But when we got moving, the other bodies was only dropping just short of the crest of that hill, of the hill at the top. And we were up. Well, of course, when we got so far, here it was, barbed wire about that high, about 4 foot high. Apron had barbed wire. And of course, we couldn't do much about that. We had to get through it. Obviously, we got wire breakers and all that. But the trouble was that your bloody rifle was in the road, so you had to put your rifle on over your shoulder. For shoulder. And we had to hold, to get through the wire, we had to put it over your head like that. Because otherwise, you're banging, your butt's banging on the bottom of the wire. Anyway, that was when we all got tangled, well, particularly I got tangled up, you see, because we were going on quite nicely for so long, the shells were flying hither and thither, and then next thing that happened, I got myself with that rifle like that, and all of a sudden, this left arm dropped, and of course my rifle went with it. And I just said to Corporal, I think I've been hit. But the arm dangling like that is in two pieces. And so he says, well, you know what to do. I said, ah, tell me. He says, bugger off and get back as fast as you can. Dump everything you've got here. So I dumped everything except my chin hat. Took my pack off and everything. And dumped it all there. Machine gun panickings and everything just stopped them there. And then I walked back, and as I'm walking back, there's a crowd of at least 30 or 40 J's coming in from across one of the other sectors. And they joined up with me, you see. And I was talking, just trying to talk to someone. And one of them saw this arm of mine, so he took my braces off, put them down my neck, and made a sling of the bottom part of my arm. And so all I wanted to do was get in the wood and then get first aid post.
Were you in pain at all?
Do you know, I never felt a thing. Never felt a thing. And bottom of my trousers from my knees down was soaking wet in blood. I thought, my God, I didn't know what the hell had happened to me. But I managed to get down to the wood, and there was all the ambulances were lined up there, because they knew there was going to be a lot coming back. Anyway, I got in one of them, and somebody took my tunic off and put it as a pillow under my head, you see, a rest for my head. And I went down from there to Aesop's, you see, which was a big depot just near Boulogne. And no, wrong there, aren't I? No, I got to the farm, and that was when I went into a big marquee there, and it was just lit up with candles, like, you know.
Had you had any treatment at this stage?
No, nothing. This is what I'm waiting for, you see, to get something done to. All I got was made a sling with braces by that jelly. And when I went in this place, all I could hear was jelly voices. Anyway, one of the English nurses and a doctor came to see me, and that was when I must have flaked out, because when I woke up, I'd got it bandaged up and in a sling properly. And I was in a train, an ambulance train, and that was when I got down to Aberville.
Now, did you hope you'd got a blighty wound? How did you feel about the idea of a blighty wound?
When you've got only one arm, probably, you know you've got a bloody blighty wound, don't you? You don't want anybody to tell you.
Would you have been pleased before at the idea of a blighty wound? Was it something you talked about?
Oh, people used to talk about getting a blighty. They were absolute rubbish. What was the use of doing that? What could you do? You couldn't time it. Yeah. They used to say that just a bit of a joke. They'd like, if they were fed up, they said, I wish I could get bloody blighty, you see. That was all it was.
But they didn't mean it.
No, it wasn't serious, no. They would want to get flashed up. If you got a blighty wound, you might get more than a wound. You might be finished off altogether. I don't think many of them were out there just to get killed, were they? So
what happened there? You got to Aberville?
Well, they got to Aberville, and that was a very funny thing, because they pulled me out of the train, the ambulance train. We went down by train to Aberville, and there was these ambulances lined up there for us. And I got in one ambulance, and I was with three more fellas. But they'd lost their arms, lost limbs, arm and leg. Anyway, we were driven down this roadway to apparently what turned out to be the hospital. But what a drive, bloody hell. The roadway was just like, you know, nothing on earth. And the strangest thing was that when we got there to the hospital, these big fellows, that looked like big fellows, big as rather, they were these orderlies come to take us out of the ambulance and into the hospital. Our orderlies. And when he opened the door, this person came round the back, and it was a young girl, she was about the same age as me. I asked her, I said, how old are you, love? She said, 18. How old are you? I said, 18. So she said, I was sorry about the... She was apologising to us for a rough ride, but she says the road is full of shallows.
Did it cause a lot of pain to you and the others?
It didn't do us any good, did it? No. Anything like that, and you've got an arm here all raw and everything just bandaged up. Anyway, that's where I went they took me in the theatre there, in the opera, and that's where they took the shrapnel out my arm, you see. That's where they took that out. And when I woke up, it was well into Sunday morning, and I got this big Thomas' splint on my arm right out, like a trombone thing. And it was tidied up and everything, and on the end of it where the turn was, they bandaged it in such a way and they got the wrist and pulled it tight, the bandages, and tied it on the top of the trombone thing. It was a special splint, and hung dangling on that was a piece of shrapnel wrapped up in a back in a piece of bandage. And all of a sudden I saw this face come over me, looking down at me. And when I looked at her, about 6 foot, I thought, he's a big one. He said, how are you feeling? Well, I was busy maze, yeah. I eventually, a few minutes, I said, I'm not bad. I said, what is it? He said, how old are you, son? So I told him. And all he said is, bloody shame. I thought, you've not bloody got it, I've got it, you know. Anyway, we didn't lose any time at all, because we came out of there, I came out of there in the afternoon, and we came down to Cali. And when we got to Cali, I could see out up my stretcher, and the ship was there. The Ville de Liège, the ship was. That was what it was called. And when I looked at her, she was down in the water. I thought, well, it's very low tide here. And when I looked at her, you know, the gangways have got to be sloping down pretty badly to get on that thing. Anyway, we got loaded on that. Well, I was going on. We had Germans working, Jerry prisoners working on the ambulances and that, not with the ships. Anyway, this was, you know, September, the end of September, and when we got down, this ship, this Ville de Liège, she'd been a coaster, cargo boat, and they absolutely gutted all them, you see, and she had been gutted and made into an ambulance ship. So we went down, and there's a big saloon there. It was all, you know, laid out with stretchers and that. Well, when we got in there, I'm tied from this wrist of mine to the end of my berth where I was, both ends, and then to the wall of the ship. And when I looked round a bit, I thought, not much chance if anything happens to this damn thing, I know where I'm going. So, anyway, one of the officers came along about 3:30. He said, sleep tight, you're all right, we're not going tonight, it's too rough. So, well, I thought, that's a pretty good idea to start, sorry. So I said, aren't we going? He says, no, too rough. Anyway, it was about 4 o'clock. And I've been in ships all my life. And I heard it. You know, the pumping of the engines. I thought, we're bloody going. And we were. And nobody come near us to tell us anything about it. And about 2 hours later, well, I couldn't tell how exactly what time it would be, but it seemed only a shortish time. And then, thump, it happened. I thought, well, it's something. I was bloody hard. And I come down and said, all right now, lads, you're home. We were in Dover. And it just took us about 2 hours. And I must have been in trouble all the time, because when I got out at Dover, they took us through from the boat to Dover Station. And of course, and everything was blacked out, you know, and we went through these blacked outs and into the station. And Dover Station was completely a mass of ambulance trains, you see. Well, I went, was taken in one, and I was in the top berth. And the nurses on the station, they got all this medical staff and that, you know, doctors, nurses, and all of that. And I'm, you know, all the assistance necessary for it. And one of these sisters were coming along the train, just walking through, and I wouldn't look at everybody to see if they were all right for travelling. So she came to me, I said, where are we going, love? She says, London Orthopaedic. Oh, I says, that might be bad, aren't it? And then she put her hand under the ear, right, under my arm. She said, I don't think you're going, though. So out she went, down to the bottom of the station where all the noises were. And she brought a doctor back, and he had a feel at it. And he says, take him up to Western Heights. Well, Western Heights was the Dover, Dover Hospital. It was right on the edge of the Dover Cliffs. So out I come into another ambulance and straight up to Dover Heights.
Now, why was that? What was worrying them?
They thought I'd got a serious hemorrhage. Anyway, I got in there and they seemed to be doing all sorts with me. And I didn't know what was happening. I was just taking it in my stride. And that was on the Monday night. Was it Sunday? That was on the Monday night, yeah. No. Sunday night. When I got in there. And I was in the then bed, right at the top end of the ward. And I put anything the following night, on Monday, about 6 o'clock in the evening, I was looking down the ward, and all of a sudden the door opened, and who should come walking in with my dad, that old man, with his pot hat and his morning coat. And he comes walking down the ward, and he sees me there, and I says, before I open my mouth, he turned around and he says, how long have you been smoking? Well, I started smoking while I was in France, but
you told me about the two.
Yes, but that was what he said, how long you've been smoking. I said, aren't I entitled to? Oh, he said, I didn't know you were. He said, have you got any cigs? Well, of course, we got miles of cigarettes, you know, from overseas and that sent to us, and I've got a line of them on the mantelpiece just the side of my bed. So I said, do you want some? He said, we can't get them at home. So I said, take the whole bloody lot for you. What's brought you down here? I said, and then he said, they sent a telegram from us and a railway warrant, and they said you were seriously ill. How are you? He said. Well, I said, couldn't tell you anything about how I am. I'm just let it go over my head. I don't know whether it's serious, how long it will be, or what's going to happen to me. I'll have to take it as it comes. Well, they only stopped till the next day, and then they pushed off home. But I believe when he's coming down, he got on the tubes, he run around London about four times before he could get off at the right station. But on a Saturday of that week, he came down to me, and the horse says, "You're going home tomorrow." No, on a Friday, "You're going home tomorrow." And then on a Saturday, we were taking, those that were going out were taken up to Dover Station, and there was a huge ambulance train. It was coaches galore in it, and we were all loaded into that. And so the next thing, I thought, where are we going? I didn't get to know there and then. But eventually we've been going so long, I've got a window seat. I could see through the windows, you know, of the train. And I thought, we've been going a lot. We started out there at 2:30 in the afternoon from Dover. And I'm waiting to get to London, you know. Like everybody else, that's a breaking up shop for London, from anything coming south to go north. And I thought, it went on and went on and went on, and at about, I should say what, about 2:30 on a Sunday morning, we were in London Old Station. The train pulled in, now Piccadilly Station. And when I looked out at the train, of course it was dark as hell then, you know, and all lacked out, but our train lit up what we were inside, and the platforms were absolutely heaving with stretchers. The whole of that station was practically full of stretchers, and the people that was in there, up there, people galore, were walking in and out amongst the stretchers, asking you, "Did you know what regiment were you on? Did you know where they saw us?" You were there lying there in agony, wanting to get somewhere in a comfortable bed for the night. But they covered it all. See, they started taking them out and putting them in ambulances. And I said to one nurse, I said, where are we going? She says, "Oh, somewhere around here, anywhere we can pick you, all around Manchester and area." I said, "Have you got anything going to Salford Royal?" She says, "I think so." Oh, I said, "Well, get me in there if you can. I only live about a quarter of a mile from there." So anyway, she came back, she says, "I'm sorry, last one for Salford Royal has just gone." Oh, I said, "That'd be my luck." Anyway, I finished up in St George's in Stockport. It was a school, a church school. Like a school, it was a school belonging to a church. And we were in there, you see, when we got in there. They came around, the doctors and all that, and then all of a sudden, a nice little nurse came along with a bowl of them, washing a wash bowl, and she put it on the chair. I thought, "You're going to really drown me." But I said, "What are you going to do?" She said, "I'm going to bath you." I said, "That's going to be fun, isn't it?" And poor kid, she blushed like anybody's business. She was only young. All these people were all young ones in that particular time. Anyway, she bathed me all that. She knew all the tricks. And then she said, "You can have your reward." And she brought me down a bottle of Guinness. Well, I didn't drink then, but she said, "Get that, it'll be good, you need it." You see. And then from there, I went up to, about half a fortnight there, I went to Birchill at Rochdale, the big infirmary, 700 bedder. And we were there then right through I was there on the when the armistice was signed, and my armistice seat was a boiled egg and a bit of bread and butter. That was all you got.
How did you feel about them when you heard the news of armistice? What did you think?
Well, like everybody else, we're absolutely fed up to the teeth with it. We were relief. It was just a feeling of relief, that was what it was. And then it all had to be started as regards to the dead and the wounded. Every school, every other school in England was converted to a hospital, so you can tell how many wounded there were. When I came home from there, the first weekend they let me come home, I had some possession done and I had to go to Langworthy Road School. Each morning I was home from the Friday till the Monday, and each morning I had to go to Langworthy Road School for my dressing, and that was a complete hospital. It's unbelievable what that war was. They talk about this was a second war. We used to bury more in the morning before our breakfast, and they'd lose in a bloody month. The casualties in the second war was nothing to what they were in the first. It was absolutely unbelievable.
How did you feel about having been wounded so late in the war? Did it upset you? I mean, you were only 5-6 weeks off the end of the war.
I asked the people, I would be my bloody luck. That's all there is about it. It's a case of I could have been killed.
So you didn't let it bother you?
When I got I had my arms up there holding my rifle. Well, the shrapnel that hit me, it hit me in my elbow. You look at that elbow, where that elbow goes. That elbow, if it hadn't been an inch higher and just under my, gone under my tin hat, I could have been a dead one. Easy. Because it hit me there, you see, in the other arm, and you take the level there. If it had got
level with
your
head.
I wouldn't have needed to have all this worry. I thought that would be it.
So you didn't let it bother you?
Well, it was no use worrying about getting killed or even wounded. If it would come your way, that was it, wasn't it?
Now, how badly damaged was your arm? When did you find out what had happened and how you because it restricted your movement a lot, didn't it?
Well, it can't do anything with it, lad. No.
What had actually happened? What had it broken?
Well, it went in there, you see. It went in at the back of the elbow, there, you see. That's where the shrapnel actually went in, you see. And it smashed. There's three bones there, like that, you know, in the knuckle. Well, it smashed all them three. And this part, you could hold that and knock that and it'd spin around. You see, broken, completely broken. The only thing that was holding it was a bit of flesh and the skin. You see, that was holding it on. And when I got to what they'd done, rather, at Aberville, they'd pushed the three bones together and made a solid block and to knit together. And that's what's happened, you see, because I can only turn that so far. I can't turn it like that, you see. I can grip a bit with it. If I couldn't have gripped, they'd have had it off, because all the tendons, you see, there, would have gone. It didn't. It only wanted to be, you say, a split inch, the most minute bit higher than where it went in, and it got the tendons. Well, then the armour had gone up like that, and it'd been useless. That'd be one for the bucket, you see. But
how soon was it before? What sort of state were you in at armistice? What state was your arm in? Had it begun to knit together by then?
Oh, it was beginning to knit all the time, you see. But I wasn't allowed to move for 3 months. I was on my back for 3 months, and that was when I was all to Rochdale and
Stockport.
We'd been Stockport first, and then we went to Birch Hill in Rochdale.
Sorry, yeah.
And I couldn't use anything of this at all, and it was a nuisance in bed and anything. I could only use one hand, and of course I had to be fed of some things, other things I could sort of take with just the one hand, liquids and that. But it was a hell of an impediment, and I was going to wonder what the hell was going to happen to it. But